Welcome to Revolutionary Business School, where we don't teach you how to climb the corporate ladder. We teach you how to burn it down, compost the ashes, and grow food for us in its place. Our syllabus will show you how to stop hustling for the system and start hustling against it. Because we don't churn out CEOs, we cultivate revolutionaries. We don't teach you how to close deals, we teach you how to open doors. And we're not here to maximize shareholder value, we're here to maximize the collective good. Join us for classes like Fundamentals of Mutual Aid, Post-Work Futures, Networking for Insurrectionists, Principles of Revolutionary Marketing, Intro to Anarchist Supply Chains, and many, many more. Ready to enroll? Together, we'll write the business plan for a world without bosses. Let's get to work. On a serious note, I'm not saying we're actually going to hustle, grind, set our way out of capitalism. I know that capitalist realism infects our spaces enough as it is. My goal here isn't to say we should look to Amazon or Microsoft to copy their successes. I simply want to take some of the ideas that are typically found in a capitalist context and bring them into a revolutionary context to see what sticks. Co-opting capitalist concepts for anti-capitalist causes to launch the business of revolution. Before you start a business, you need a plan. You need to understand the business you're getting into and the product or service you're hoping to provide. You need a plan for operations, human resources, marketing, and finance. I need an assessment of the risks of the business and how they can be mitigated. This breakdown of business planning is not that far off from what's necessary to break away from business as usual. To illustrate what I mean, we're going to start sketching out a plan for a social revolutionary project. I typically speak of social revolution, which is a complete transformation of our society, economy, culture, philosophy, technology, relationships, and politics, as a combined effort of the things we do to oppose the current system and the things we do to propose an alternative. You need both to create lasting change. So we're going to come up with a plan that combines the occupation and reclamation of a dying mall by workers and nearby residents with the development of a library economy that utilizes that mall space. If you don't know what a library economy is, check out this video for a full explanation. But basically, it's a collectively organized system of several different commons, which catalogues and provides access to a collection of goods and resources to all members of a society. I know that the idea of people coming together to seize and socialize a dying mall sounds a bit out of this world and impossible right now, but that's the point of attempting to envision it anyway. To borrow the words that are often attributed to Nelson Mandela, it always seems impossible until it's done. How can we expect to accomplish anything revolutionary if we limit ourselves before we've even begun? Of course, at the end of the day, this is a purely hypothetical, an immersive work of fiction, if you will. So to start off with, we need to understand what it is we're trying to accomplish. We're going against the system and we're building something different. We're trying to develop a new form of commons that has very little precedent. But perhaps we can borrow from business school by finding some use in a PESL analysis. That's where we analyze the political, economic, social, technological, environmental, and legal factors that could impact our efforts. Politically, the government will obviously not be on our side, but we could take advantage of political trends like new urbanism and anti-corporate populism to leverage support. Economically, conditions like the ever-rising cost of living and the loss of livelihoods caused by the death of the mall could also motivate support by our fellow workers and neighbours. Socially, if our project involves the revitalization of a dying mall, it can only benefit from the rise in popularity of solarpunk and lifestyle shifts away from brick-and-mortar consumerism. Technologically, both library management systems and inventory management software could potentially be useful in organizing the storage and distribution of the goods being expropriated. Environmentally, the ecological impact of most malls is absolutely horrendous, but it'll be an interesting challenge to find ways to turn that impact from a net negative to a net positive. Finally, legally, I don't think you need to be Saul Goodman to know that occupation, expropriation, and reclamation are not exactly aligned with the law. But on the other hand, the law isn't exactly aligned with our liberation. That's the PESL analysis in a nutshell. We also need to know our strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. So we need a SWOT analysis. Today's material conditions provide ample opportunities for this project to succeed. The economic failures of malls make them prime targets for reclamation, and popular interest in sustainability and alternative economies could foster the engagement we need. With the right partnerships, such as with unions or other movements, our chance of success could be even greater. The strengths, I believe, are obvious. This project empowers workers and residents to transform a space of urban decay into one of urban renewal. The proliferation of the library economy would lower people's living expenses and reduce overconsumption. Reclaiming a mall makes this project particularly potent, as malls' flexible layouts can accommodate all sorts of uses, including libraries of things and makerspaces and even housing. Not to mention, the visible success of such a project could inspire other communities to follow suit. However, our weaknesses and threats are also apparent, as externally, authorities are not going to stand by and let this happen without a fight. Police intervention risks both the sustainability of the project and the lives of its supporters. Mass media campaigns could easily demonize perceptions, and internally, the uphill battle to source the local participation and efforts necessary for the project to succeed might prove too great to overcome. Without that support, the strain on those involved and their resources might become too much to bear. If such a project were to collapse, it might inspire other efforts elsewhere that learn from its mistakes, but it might just as easily inspire disillusionment. With our very brief situational analysis out of the way, we can get into the specifics of the project itself. I'm going to launch into a quick tangent, but it's necessary to establish the basis of my perspective before we proceed. Ready? I'm coming from an anarchist perspective, which means that I oppose all authority along with its justifying dogmas, and instead propose the unending pursuit of anarchy, which is not what you've probably been led to believe. It is not a world of unmitigated violence. It's a world without rule where self-determination, mutuality, and free association form the basis of our society. Being against authority doesn't mean I don't leave room for listening to expertise or coordinating my efforts with others. It just means that I don't place any people or procedures in a position where they command others. I don't believe that command, the authority, is necessary. Authority refers to the recognized right above others in a social relationship to command obedience, control property, exploit collective force, and so on. Anarchists oppose authority because those subject to authority become controlled, dependent, exploited, and prevented from freely accessing their full potential, or even the bare minimum. By getting rid of the right of authority, which gives privilege to the desires of some over others, we create a society of equals, where nobody has a right above anybody else. Nothing is allowed, and nothing is disallowed. That doesn't mean people can or will go around causing harm without consequence. A world of warlords is still a world of authorities. It simply means that everybody is free to act and to face the full consequences of their actions, positive and negative. Nobody is shielded from consequences by the protection and privilege of authority. However, as we are in every type of society, we're still mutually interdependent, meaning we're still reliant on the network of relationships that sustain our lives. So the result of such a society would be the systemic incentive to maintain social harmony by exercising restraint and consulting those who may be affected by our actions to find compromise where necessary. It's a lot to grasp all at once, and I've only explored some of it in depth on my channel before. But you can check out these videos, read these books and articles, and stay tuned for future videos if you're hungry for more. So back to how this relates to the project. In a capitalist business, the organization of people typically falls within the spheres of the operational plan and the human resources plan. The operational plan serves to outline how the business will achieve its goals through things like production and service procedure, competitive advantages, and the relationships with various suppliers. The human resources plan focuses on organizing the workforce with a hierarchical organization chart and includes the benefits and entitlements of key personnel. As you can imagine, our mall reclamation project's daily operations and human resources will function entirely differently. Anarchists have an alternative approach to organization. It's not direct democracy, as that's a more recently communalist approach that anarchists have historically opposed for a wide variety of reasons. It's not no organization, unless you erroneously treat organization as a synonym for hierarchies or polities. Rather, anarchist organization emerges from the founding principle of free association. Free association means that each person is free to move around, group with, and separate from others, based on their interests, without being subject to authority. Our interests might be as broad as keeping the mall clean, or as niche as preserving the art of filigree in the former jewelry store to make a space. Our interests might thus span the entire mall, or they might be localized to a single store. A group might form for a specific task, like replacing a light bulb, or carry on for an indefinite task, like maintaining the hydroponic system in the food court's Auntie Anne's. I mean, nobody's gonna miss the overpriced pretzels, right? Groups might overlap with a shared interest in hosting an event in the central atrium, or come into conflict over different stances on how certain resources are allocated. Since nobody can order around anybody else, the ability to accomplish anything becomes proportional to how many people want to do it and what compromise they can find with others. This creates a social fabric that is continuously altered as groups form, dissolve, overlap, split, and merge according to their needs. This is anarchy in action, a form of social organization that has yet to fully blossom. The goals that groups form around should be smart if they want to be successful. By smart, I mean that our goals should be specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. For example, if a group wants to establish a makerspace in the former electronics store, which is relevant to the project's desire to foster skill sharing and self-sufficiency, they might measure that specific goal with the aim of installing a 3D printer, sewing machine, and laser cutter, attained by sourcing donations of equipment within the time span of 2 weeks. But how exactly do groups form and connect with others in such a context? The revolution will not be televised or found on Microsoft Teams, so this is where I think spaces of encounter become valuable. Rather than being sites of centralized decision-making, spaces of encounter are places where people of diverse interests can find and connect with others of common interest. It's not a single social body, but a space where individuals can meet and groups can form, share their perspectives, information, and ideas, consult with each other, and take on different projects of their own volition. Spaces of encounter can form anywhere, from the mall's central atrium, to the food court, to a mall-wide group chat. Groups organized around specific libraries may meet in a space of encounter to share notes, a group formed to advocate for accessibility may share their recommendations with others, and a group engaged in the defense of the project from outside threats may provide intelligence updates. But how do we get people to organize this way? Here's where I think it's important to understand the role of powers, drives, and consciousness in the development, maintenance, and defense of this project. Powers refers to our abilities and capacities to act, to be, and to experience. It requires both internal powers and external conditions. If we take the power to cook, for example, you need the internal capacity to cook, but you also need the actual kitchen and ingredients to use that power. More broadly, to borrow the words of Paul Rijkstad and Sofa Shaugredin, who and what we connect and relate to, and how we do so, profoundly affects what we can do and become. The systems we live in and the relationships we are part of shape the development of our powers, for better and for worse. Drives refers to the motivations, wishes, goals, values, and desires that propel our activity. As our powers expand, so do our drives, which are also shaped internally and externally. The better you get at cooking, for example, the more you may want to develop your skills and upgrade your kitchen accordingly. Finally, consciousness refers to the capacity for reflection and deliberate action. It enables us to evaluate and adapt to our present circumstances, and also imagine and strategize to create a better future. We need both theory and practice to expand our consciousness, as they give us the language and experience we need to pursue change. If our consciousness is limited or misleading, that can hamper our capacity for change. It's popular nowadays to dismiss theory altogether and focus entirely on action. But if we don't unlearn the biases, prejudices, and assumptions of the status quo, and actually understand what we profess to believe, what we're trying to achieve, and how to get there, then we might spend time, energy, and resources pursuing means that will never achieve our desired ends. For this moral reclamation project to launch and succeed, its participants must develop the anarchic powers, drives, and consciousness that can only come from the education of its possibility and the experience of its actuality, knowledge, and practice. Anarchists seek to share the knowledge and create the conditions that will produce more anarchists, who will then be motivated to defend their newfound freedom. Among the arguments made against anarchism is that humans aren't good enough to handle anarchy. On the contrary, anarchists believe that it is because of our human flaws that we cannot afford to accept authority. Kropotkin famously laid out this counter-argument in Are We Good Enough? To paraphrase, he said if people are as greedy, selfish, and servile as the critics say, then we must eliminate the hierarchical conditions that foster these flaws, not perpetuate them. In his own words, we maintain that both rulers and ruled are spoiled by authority. Both exploiters and exploited are spoiled by exploitation. We admit the imperfections of human nature, but we make no exception for the rulers. Because people are flawed, even in anarchy, there will still be harm. Even before we even get that far ahead, especially in the initial stages of a project as ambitious as a moral reclamation, there will be participants who cause harm. So how do we deal with these people? How do we respond to harm? There are some who propose that the existence of harm is enough justification to institute authority. But positions of authority provide avenues for even greater harm, and the institution of such positions also defeats the entire purpose of the project. Others attempt to do away with the authority of rulers while still retaining rules. but rules generally imply the existence of authority, even an authority as abstract and broad as the people. Because for a rule to be a rule, it has to be binding and enforceable. Enforceable rules are equivalent to laws, and unenforceable rules, or rules that don't require enforcement, are not really rules at all. They're more like suggestions or norms of behavior. So where does that leave those of us who are opposed to authority? The reality we have to confront is that harm can never be fully reined in by rules or laws, because rules cannot capture all the possible situations where harm can occur. And rules can permit harm just as much, if not more, than they prohibit it. The law allows the rich to exploit land and labor, and the law defends the violence of the state. And as the French author Anatole France famously observed, the law, in its majestic equality, forbids rich and poor alike to sleep under bridges, to beg in the streets, and to steal their bread. There is no system that is ever going to completely get rid of harm. But in the absence of permission and prohibition, in the absence of protections for authorities and their harm, and in the absence of preordained punishments, we are free to respond to harm by finding solutions that are tailored to its specifics. We are free to act, and so are others. However, as a social species, we are also mutually interdependent. The mutual nature of this freedom thus incentivizes mutual responsibility. So while this project may not have HR to handle these kinds of issues, if it is launched on the basis of organizing anarchy, then it still has the incentive to find solutions, restore harm, and defend against internal and external threats. What those solutions are exactly will vary on a case-by-case basis, but may look like mediation, restoration, social sanctions, or mutual defense. Before we continue, what have we done so far? We've come up with an analysis of our political, economic, social, technological, environmental, and legal situation, developed an awareness of our strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats, established a different approach to daily operations and human resources based on free association instead of rigid hierarchies, established the importance of smart goals, conceptualized spaces of encounter, explored the role of powers, drives, and consciousness, and attempted to address the reality of harm. So what's next? Well, capitalist businesses often sink or swim on the basis of their marketing plan. For a project like this, our marketing plan is focused on educating our fellow participants and promoting a positive image to the public. The education side of this project takes place even before the project has begun, through the practice of social insertion. This is where anarchists get involved in the daily struggles of the oppressed, and through that involvement, grow the influence of anarchist values and practices within those struggles. That might be through conversations with fellow mall workers trying to form a union, an educational pamphlet or video shared between tenants facing eviction, or a book club organized among involved activists. As trust is built, knowledge is shared, and reputation is earned, anarchists can aid in the creation of a consciously revolutionary movement capable of undertaking a project as rich in potential as this. The public relations side of this project occurs through relationship building with nearby residents and the practice of solidarity with adjacent movements and causes. We could host events that showcase the project's benefits and invite our neighbors' involvement. Imagine a single parent struggling to make ends meet and finding refuge in a reclaimed mall that organizes free childcare, a shared pantry, and even accommodations if they need it. This could be a lifeline for people left behind by the system. For the wider world, the PR of revolutionary projects isn't merely a matter of good optics in the eyes of the masses or the media, which often side with authority and injustice. The target audience for those in pursuit of liberation is found among the marginalized populations who see its need the most. We reach that audience through meaningful solidarity. Solidarity is a mutual commitment among people to support and care for one another, recognizing that our well-being is interconnected. Solidarity means sharing resources, amplifying voices, being willing to put your own comfort on the line, recognizing that their liberation is tied to yours, and acting accordingly. We need to expand our understanding and practice of solidarity for social revolution to flourish. A project as ambitious as a mall reclamation will depend on the support and solidarity of those outside of it to survive. There's one more concept I want to introduce to this unconventional approach to a marketing plan. American sociologist Everett Rogers developed the diffusion of innovations theory to explain how, why, and at what rate new ideas and technologies spread. Part of that theory classifies individuals into categories based on their innovativeness. Innovators are the risk takers first to adopt new ideas. Early adopters are the next group to adopt new ideas and very influential in their spaces. The early majority are the people who value new ideas, but are a bit cautious on the outset and need to see them in action before they're sold. The late majority are very resistant to change and skeptical of new ideas, not getting involved until they're more well-established. And finally, the laggards are the last to adopt new ideas and may never do so due to their preference for tradition and extreme aversion to change. To the extent that this analysis can be applied to our situation, I believe that in these very early stages of social revolution, our time and energy as innovators is best spent on first understanding our own ideas, bringing in early adopters, and then bridging the chasm to reach and convince that early majority of the viability of our ideas through education and experience. So where do finances come into play? Internally, we can be as communist as we'd like, or even experiment with things like time-based currency and mutual credit systems. But the full transformation of a dying mall will require resources that we simply may not have internal access to. That means that in the early stages of this project and other endeavors, we will still have to interact with the capitalist economy. And that requires money. Such a problem may be solved in the short term by sourcing sympathetic grants or using crowdfunding, but in the long term, we will need the backing of a fully functional alternative economy that can meet people's needs and withstand isolation from the capitalist economy. Only by building and expanding a broader network will we have any chance of lasting success. At last, we come to our risk assessment and mitigation strategy. We've already explored many of the risks of this revolutionary endeavor, such as legal action, resource constraints, and internal conflict. And we've seen how we might address them, through organized defense, solidarity, and conflict resolution practices. But at the end of the day, the risk of such a project is massive. And as I said in the beginning, it can seem entirely impossible. Here's where my partial and nascent answers become open-ended questions. You see, there's only so much that we can plan for in advance. No blueprint will ever be perfect, and no amount of planning will remove all the risks. The rest can only be figured out through action, trial and error, and the collective creativity that emerges when people come together to create something new. How might our project be isolated, and how could we offset that isolation? What actions, strategies, and approaches can aid our resistance to repression? Are there ways to overcome isolation and avoid repression without ceding ground to the system? What kind of alliances and collaborations could benefit or hamper our efforts? And if this project succumbs to repression, how might it still inform us after it ceases to be? The ideas that I've explored in this video and the questions I've now posed can be applied to more than just the reclamation of a dying mall. We can examine everything we do to oppose and propose. As always, revolutionary work starts in our minds. If we're willing to embrace its uncertainty and act in the spirit of anarchy, we might then find solutions we can't yet imagine. But we have to be willing to step into that unknown. It's only by daring to act that we stand a chance of turning the impossible into the inevitable. All power to all the people. Peace. Thanks for watching. Please like, comment, subscribe, and share with your fellow peoples. Thanks to the seedlings, the saplings, and especially the roots for making all of this possible, including our newest members, Fire Tools, Annie, Mizumo, Rafi, and Elizabeth C. Birdsong. You can join these beautiful humans and support me too on patreon.com/SaintDrew. Check out my other videos for a range of radical topics. Thanks again. Peace.